This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and this week the grades are in for many North Carolina public schools. It's the annual release of the Adequate Yearly Progress Reports. And because of more stringent standards this year, the testing scores for middle and elementary school children in the state are generally worse than they were last year. These tests were ordered up as part of the No Child Left Behind law, aimed at getting schools to put special emphasis on raising the test scores of certain groups of children who may have been traditionally disadvantaged in the past. The question is, are the No Child Left Behind tests a tide that raises all boats, or are some schools and students still drowning? What, then, is the best approach to help more students? What would be the best measure? Today on The State of Things, we are asking that question. What will North Carolina public schools look like in 10 years? Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Testing, vouchers, segregation, charter schools, teacher training, and school safety. Just some of the topics that could come up for discussion about the future of North Carolina schools. We have asked three guests to join us this hour to help envision the future and talk about the No Child Left Behind. With us are Eddie Davis, who is Executive Director of the North Carolina Association of Educators. Welcome back, Eddie.
Well, thank you. Actually, I'm the president.
Oh, I'm sorry, the president of the NCAE. And Bruce Buchanan is the K-12 education reporter with the Greensboro News and Record.
Hello.
Welcome. Hi there, Bruce. And Linda Lynn Kakadelis is the director of the North Carolina Education Alliance, and she joins us by phone from Charlotte. Hi there, Linda Lynn.
Hello.
Hi. Well, 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Bruce, I'd like to start out with you. You have been reporting on this about the schools in the triad, but I think what happens there can be said to be happening across the state.
Sure.
Remind us once again of the basic requirements of No Child Left Behind and what it seeks to accomplish with this testing.
Well, the original goal of No Child Left Behind was to make sure that groups of students who traditionally may have been, for lack of a better word, term left behind, low-income students, students who speak English as a second language, minority groups, to make sure that those kids aren't being lost in the shuffle, that they are getting a decent education. The mechanism for doing this is something called Adequate Yearly Progress. What it does, it uses the same state reading and math test that kids have been taking for years, but now all groups within a school, you know, all your racial and ethnic groups, low income, disabled, must meet a minimum test score. And if just one of those groups doesn't make that minimum test score in both reading and math, then the entire school doesn't make its adequate yearly progress. So it's kind of an all or nothing proposition.
It's no longer the case, I guess, you could say that you would average the highest
right.
scores in a school with the lowest scores and say that somewhere in between that's how the school did.
That's exactly what this was designed to eliminate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Eddie Davis, I'll start with you. Is the AYP, adequate yearly progress, a good thing?
Well, I think theoretically it is a wonderful idea. It would prevent, as Bruce said, any one group of students from falling through the cracks, and that attention needs to be placed on all of the students in the school. We do think that we certainly should not hide student groups within the school through the averaging process that we've used somewhat in the past. However, to have all or nothing means that the school that has one subgroup that does not make it and maybe comes very close to making it is in the same boat as schools that have multiple groups of students who have not been able to achieve at the highest level. So we really don't think it's a good gauge totally to compare schools, and this is what people often do when Bruce ranks the schools or lists the schools' progress in the Greensboro News and Record. I'm sure people are looking at where their school falls as opposed to others. And
there's also the consequence of these tests, we should say, too,
that is
that if you fail 2 years in a row,
Two years in a row, you have to offer student transfers, and now that the third year of data is out, the second round of consequences is the schools that fail have to provide private tutors for students who want them. However, it's worth noting out that these sanctions only apply to schools with large numbers of poor kids, of low children from low-income families. These are the schools that receive the federal Title I dollars. Mm-hmm. So the sanctions only apply to those schools.
Okay, 1-877-962-9862 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. Linda Lynn Kakadelis, what's your take on the AYP? Eddie Davis has pointed out there's some downside to it that, you know, it may not be doing everything that it's set out to do.
Well, I think, first of all, for parents whose children fall in the categories that they're not making adequate yearly progress, for those particular parents, they're at least knowing whether that group is achieving or not, and whether it's one group or whether it's five different groups that don't make adequate yearly progress. If you're a parent of a child who is in one of those groups, that's important to you. Mm-hmm. And so I think the president's initiative, when he said that they would leave no child behind, that's specifically what it means. That everyone has got to, every different group that is measured must meet the target. And the sanctions, like what Bruce said, they only apply to Title I schools. It's not every school in the state. It's just your Title I schools. And those are the schools where the parents have the least amount of options to do other things with their children to provide the academic achievement that the parents would want.
Mm-hmm. Well, could we just clarify something about the Title I here, because I'd like mm-hmm. to understand this more clearly. Does that mean the federal government is providing more money to schools to help remedy these situations?
Well, in some cases, there are federal funds that do follow the schools, although in many cases, people have said that some of the mandates on things that must happen are thrust upon the states and the individual school districts and schools without the federal dollars flowing. This goes back to the idea of the federal government dealing with compensatory education based on the 14th Amendment. And we have had the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, for many, many years, and this is really what this is. It's called No Child Left Behind in the Bush administration, but it's really the reauthorization of the ESEA. There are monies put aside so that kids who are in so-called Title I schools or sometimes called Chapter I schools can indeed have this money to catch up so that they can compete with students from other schools. So it's a good thing. However, we want to make sure, just as Linda said, and I think I agree with you, that we need to offer attention to every single group of children and every single child so that none of them are left behind. The school folks, I think, are just concerned about whether or not the mandates are unfunded or fully funded.
Mm. Well, and I think the mandate there, Eddie, is that every child performs at whatever the state determines standards,
yes.
Minimal standards. And so it's not, you know, extra mandates. It's just we want they're saying every child needs to be educated to the state standard.
Yeah, when I use the word mandate, I'm talking about making sure that the funding is mandated as well as the standard of academic success.
But if that money is already going into the Chapter I schools, is that what they're called?
Well,
to the Title I schools. Is this a case of Peter and Paul overseeing the funding arrangement? I mean, is that actually more money that could go to those schools, or are those schools going to get that money and they just have to spend it, say, tutoring those children who
right.
need it? Would that be money that's being taken away from other students in that school, that Title I school?
Well, it does redirect money that's already going to these schools, so they're not necessarily getting any extra money to provide these transfers or tutors. However, I'm sure supporters of No Child Left Behind might say that if these schools aren't meeting the standards, then maybe they weren't spending the money appropriately to begin with. Maybe this is what they need to be spending it on. So, you know, that's...
Well, the other piece, too, I'd like to say, Linda, is Melinda and Linda and Bruce, is that in many cases, the schools, though, that may not be performing at the highest level, the idea is to make sure that the money is spent in a manner so that they will achieve at a higher level. But to
right.
some degree, if they haven't had the success rate and they aren't able to do it in a couple of years, then the money that could go to that school actually gets transferred to some other school. So that poor performing school ends up losing the funding that would leave with the students.
That's if parents take the option of not having the child tutored at that school, but
that's correct.
Going to another
that's
one. Correct. Linda Lynn, are you optimistic that the No Child Left Behind, as it stands right now, can bring on the changes that it sought to bring on, and 10 years from now, we may just look at this as growing pains in that process?
Well, interesting that you brought that up. Anytime that there is law-based reform, and this is what this is, it's law-based reform, it may have some effect, but to really have the effect of helping the child, I think what we're going to have to do is go to more of a market-based, and where we have competition, we have money attached to the child than just money attached to a system. And
so you're in favor, if I'm reading between the lines there, you're talking about vouchers?
Well, tax credit vouchers, it can come in lots of different ways. But where you really have market-based reforms, that I think will expedite the system into doing whatever's necessary to meet the needs of children. Whereas a law-based reform, you're still, even with the sanctions that are placed upon the system gets to determine if there's public school choice in the second year of sanctions, what schools those parents can choose to send their child to. And I know in the case of Wake County, the schools that were picked for the parents were not very good options for the parents. I mean, they were too far away from them. It was kind of a token.
Right. We will get back to our conversation with Linda Lynn Kekadelis, who is director of the North Carolina Education Alliance, Eddie Davis with the North Carolina Association of Educators, and Bruce Buchanan, education reporter with the Greensboro News and Record. We're talking about the future of public education in North Carolina. No Child Left Behind. Where will it lead? Join our conversation, 1-877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. We are talking today about the future of North Carolina's public schools, and we're looking at this against the backdrop of the No Child Left Behind law. The results of the AYP, or Adequate Yearly Progress Reports, are now in for elementary and middle schools in the state. A record number of schools have failed this AYP for this, the third year of such testing. AYP is a provision of the No Child Left Behind Act, and the No Child Left Behind Act has received mixed reviews across the country. Some states, including Connecticut and Utah, consider opting out of this federal mandate. With us to talk about all of this right now are Bruce Buchanan, who is education reporter for the Greensboro News and Record, Eddie Davis, the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, and Linda Lynn Kekadelis, who is director of the North Carolina Education Alliance. We welcome your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Deborah is on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Hi there.
I would just like for the panel to address the particular concern that I have about the annual testing process. I'm the parent of a middle schooler who is academically advanced and became so distressed with the focus on testing in the state of North Carolina that I moved my child into a private school because I want him to learn for the love of learning and not to learn toward taking a test. And I wonder if the panel can address that concern for me.
Mm-hmm. Eddie Davis, do you want to start with that?
Well, we hear this complaint a lot that there is a focus on testing, and things that are not tested are not taught in some schools. Now, we certainly don't want to make that accusation for all schools. So we do know that there is this major focus. There has to be some accountability measure, and standardized testing seems to be the way that most schools have dealt with it, although there are some places that have dealt with authentic assessment as an alternative, but they still have to deal with these tests.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bruce Buchanan?
This is a legitimate concern, one you hear come up time and time again. The adequate yearly progress requires all groups to get up to a minimum passing score.
Is passing what we would have thought of as D before? Is D a passing score?
It's on grade level is the requirement. So if you're already on grade level, there's really not a whole lot of incentive for the schools to accelerate you beyond that. So kids who are already doing well in school very well may not be getting the attention that they were a generation ago, because the teacher is having to spend so much time on getting the struggling kids up to grade level. And also we're hearing that subjects besides reading and math, things like science, social studies, the arts, are getting left out in too many cases, because schools do feel a lot of pressure to perform. I guess the flip side of that is if you can't read and you can't do math, then you can't do much of anything else.
Okay. Linda Lynn Kakadelis, is that part of the issue here, that the program is based on the idea that no child should be left behind, and that is the given that all children can be brought up to grade level. But if there's a limited amount of resources, something's got to give somewhere.
Well, I think while money is important, the way you spend money is more important. And whether the schools are spending the money efficiently or not is questionable. That is a legitimate concern, that the time and energy is going to be totally focused on children who, for whatever reason, the curriculum that's being used is not working the best. But we cannot continue to have the statistics that we're having in the government monopoly of education. For example, in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, only 38% of your African-American males are graduating. In Wake County, 44% of African-American males are graduating. So something is not working somewhere. And so the focus and the attention has been given to children for whatever reasons are falling through the cracks.
Mm-hmm. And just before the break, you made the case for, if I was hearing correctly, for vouchers, for providing that as that could be what this leads to as a solution. Eddie Davis, you're with the North Carolina Association of Educators, opposed to vouchers.
We would be vehemently opposed to taking public money and giving it to private schools. We certainly believe that people have the option, and many people choose the option of putting their children in private schools, but we just don't believe that that's a wise use of public money, just like we don't think if some neighborhoods decided they want to have their own police safety and security, we should not ask them not to pay for, they still are expected to pay for the police that we have in our system.
So where do you see...
Can I just make 2 points? You know, Eddie made a point that, you know, some people can afford to pay twice, and that's exactly right. Some people can't afford to pay twice, but the people I'm talking about are really the ones that cannot afford to pay twice, and they are stuck in a government monopoly system. And by paying twice, I mean paying tuition and paying by their taxes. And no one is saying that everybody shouldn't pay taxes towards schools. What we're saying is that parents ought to have the options to choose other schools than the monopoly government system.
Well, I think that we have here in North Carolina no voucher programs. We do have charter schools that are publicly financed, and that seems to be working. Lots of people who find themselves in low-income neighborhoods have chosen those charter schools, and they seem to be doing very well.
Bruce Buchanan?
Well, so far in North Carolina, there really hasn't been a lot of momentum for a voucher system politically. Maybe that will change, I don't know, but so far that really hasn't gotten off the ground here. But as Eddie mentioned, charter schools are a different kind of reform, privately run public schools that have caught on. And right now the only problem with those is the state caps the number that are available that can run at any given time throughout the state, and there are many communities that would like to have a charter school that just can't get one because of the state cap.
Okay, we go to Jack, who joins us from Whitsitt. Hi there, Jack.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the soapbox here, guys. I noticed my background is within the juvenile court. I spent 15 years as a probation officer. My disillusion with the court system was that there seemed to be no responsibility given or taken from the parents to have any responsibility for the children's actions. And I know this is a different vent from throwing money at a school system and watching something happen there. I think we're taking responsibility away from the real source where it should be, and that's within the home. If the parents are out trying to make a living and are so greedy that all they can do is think about their jobs and not what kids they put on this earth and what responsibilities they have as parents, then we're just missed the boat entirely. The kids need to have a value system established at home, and if they're not able or not capable of accepting what the schools have, then the parents need to be brought in and reestablished as to what their children need. You know, got slapped in the face.
Right. I'd like to put your comments to our guests, but also to point out that there would be a lot of parents who are working out of absolute necessity.
Oh, yeah, I know that, but there's probably, and I will point this also, those parents probably have had more children than they really needed to have. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this greedy thing of thinking that more kids makes a better system, a better family. But I've got something else to say too, if I might. The person Lynn there's favorite phrase is government monopoly system. Talking about the school system as it is, I'll bet that she is a Republican and motivated by this administration, which seems to want to privatize everything and thinks that privatization is going to be the answer to all. And I assure her that once his administration's gone and privatization is no longer the key to everything, that it's going to fall by the wayside.
Well, thank you for your call, Jack. Lindalyn Kekadelis, there were those critics of No Child Left Behind who said that this could lead down the road to privatization, that once we tried these efforts at letting kids go from the schools that were deemed to be failing after a couple of years of bad scores, that there might not be enough schools to send those kids to, and then voila, vouchers might enter the scene. And you have said you're in favor of vouchers. So is that part of the grand plan here?
Well, I don't think there's a mass conspiracy for that. I do think there is a concern that for whatever reason, some children are not getting their needs met through the one-size-fits-all system. And we need to look at other options. I think that the Department of Education, federally, they have finally said, okay, if we're going to put money into Title I schools, then we are expecting results. Now, states, you are free to choose the curriculum. You are free to choose the testing. You are free to have your standards. You're free to determine what your standard is. But whatever you have decided as your standard, then we expect children to rise to that standard. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's too much to ask. Now, if the system cannot do it, and if parents would like other options, then possibly this may show that the traditional system cannot be flexible enough to meet children's needs.
Linda, doesn't the provisions of the No Child Left Behind that do allow students to move to other schools, doesn't that sort of go in the trend area that you'd like to see us go in terms of choice and vouchers and other kinds of things? And when you say government schools, aren't you saying it sort of in a disparaging manner?
I'm sorry, Eddie, I couldn't hear you.
When you continue to refer to government schools, don't you say it in a sort of disparaging manner? Because the government really is in lots of things, including the White House is the government. Lots of things are the government. But when critics often refer to them as government schools, isn't it sort of a political term that you
use? Right. I don't mean that way. It's just that they are government schools.
Mm-hmm.
I refer to them that way versus public education, because I do believe public education includes all types of education.
But you wouldn't refer to it as the government army, would you?
Well, I could, because it does
because it is
controlled by the government.
Right.
But we don't. We only have one army that has a particular role of protecting our country. And right now, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
But I wonder if it gets to a philosophy of one's approach toward education? Because we speak of public libraries, we don't talk about government libraries. They're seen at some point. A community decided this would be a beneficial thing to have a place where people could go to get books and not pay for them. The public would do that. Just as the public currently finances the schools, the elementary and secondary schools.
Well, and let me just make it very clear. I don't think that we should not let the public provide education. I think maybe what I'm saying is that maybe the definition of public schools should be all inclusive, and right now it's not. And I had the privilege of directing Children's Scholarship Fund in Mecklenburg County. That was $3 million worth of private money for low-income families. And, you know, it was amazing. We worked with 435 children and over 70 different providers. I never had a phone call from a family that said, I love my school. It's succeeding for my child. It's wonderful. Can I please have money to go someplace else?
Can we go to the phones? Chris joins us from Raleigh. Hi, Chris.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call. My comment, just on the whole notion of vouchers, it just seems to me that there's no way to provide for vouchers and not take money away from public schools. And I would just like to say that, in my view, public schools are part of the social contract. We've agreed that we're going to communally, collectively, educate our children because it is in the public good. It's not because we want them to get good paying jobs, or I mean that may be a secondary benefit, but it's part of the social contract. And this whole collapse of public space and this whole idea that the market is going to provide every solution is it's disheartening to me. And if your panelists could comment on that, on the idea of social contract, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. Bruce Buchanan?
Well, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add, but I guess the argument to that from the pro-voucher side, and Lindland can probably speak to this much more eloquently than I, but I think the argument is that these schools belong to the public, the taxpayers, funded by the taxpayers, and if these schools aren't meeting their particular needs, why should they be locked into to a school that's not working for their child?
If we don't have vouchers, Eddie Davis, in the future, what do you see another way of getting at improving the public schools so that these test scores could be better, or dare I even say, so that students learn better?
Sure. I think I go back to a previous call. I think it was Jack who mentioned that parents need to be much more involved in the discussion about having kids prepared. I think that the whole idea of discipline needs to be an issue that we need to deal with. And some people think that that's one of the preventable causes that may keep some parents from having the confidence in the public schools that they should have. We at NCAE are working real hard to try to make sure that we have some discussions around the state to deal with solutions to school suspensions, to try to deal with that issue so that no one child will have his or her education disrupted by any other one child who might be doing things that would be destructive. So we're going to be talking a great deal about that around the state during the summer.
And as I understand, part of that is, on the one hand, you don't want a child in the classroom who's going to disrupt things so that other kids can't learn. On the other hand, there disproportionately there have been more African-American children who end up getting suspended.
That's right. We recognize that, and we are trying to have this dialogue particularly with communities of color and lower-income parents, because lots of the policymakers discuss this all the time, but we need to make sure we hear from parents and to give them ways to have solutions to some of those problems so that the front end can be dealt with rather than the actual suspensions or, even worse, the abuses of the law that may come down the road.
Okay. Wayne joins us right now from Raleigh. Hi there, Wayne.
Hello, folks. Thank you for taking my call. I myself am not a teacher. My wife is. She's been teaching for over 20 years in a couple of northern states, and she's been teaching in Wake County and Durham County for the past couple of years. The frustration that I have in seeing her deal with the current No Child Left Behind is really a twist on it, is to say we should be focused more on No Teacher Left Behind. I look at the benefits of the teachers here, the amount of administrative work that they have to record testing, try to work with children of varying knowledge, learning abilities. And I see where the classroom sizes are too large. Teacher turnover in North Carolina is way too high. My wife was the seventh language teacher to be put in her position in 1 year. She was the seventh one, and she has stuck it out in a primarily Afro-American school. So the issue I see is, if you treat the teachers, this funding about, you know, vouchers to get the child to a better place, you need to look at the infrastructure of North Carolina Teacher Association and work with them to lower the classroom sizes, change the curriculum so that they can reach children of varying learning degrees, and focus really on what the teachers need to get the job done, not all the testing, administrative reports that they need to generate, but focus on the teaching.
Yeah, well, I'd like to first put that to Linda Lynn briefly, but just before we go, and then Eddie. Linda Lynn, there is some evidence that fewer children per teacher brings better results. Is that one way to go? Is that one way to crack this one?
Well, the research does show if you can get it down to about 10 to 12 students per teacher, that you will have good results. That's what the research shows, but you have to get it down to that low of teacher-student ratio. But I'd like to take just a minute, Melinda.
Well, actually, I have to get it really quick because I want to have Eddie and Bruce go in, so we have about a minute left. So if you can say it in 10 seconds, that's good.
Okay, well, I think we need to look at some of the pilot programs that are around the United States before we continue with misinformation regarding what choice does for the public school system.
Eddie Davis?
Well, I think that we have to go in two parallel ways. I think what Wayne is talking about, we have to make sure that we are more teacher-friendly and that we recognize the tremendous job they have to have, but we also have to deal with accountability. It's an inevitable fact that we're going to have accountability.
Okay. Bruce Buchanan.
One quick point about the small class size is there's a elementary school in High Point, Fairview Elementary. 97% of the kids are low income, yet this school has made its AYP goals for 2 years in a row. Just shows that it's not easy, but it can be done.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be checking in the near future about the future of North Carolina schools. Thank you all. Linda Lynn Kakadelis is director of the North Carolina Education Alliance. Eddie Davis is president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, and Bruce Buchanan is the K-12 education reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. And just ahead on the state of things, goings-on in the Walltown neighborhood of Durham and escaping the heat. Oh, that heat in the Tar Heel State. Stay with us.